Hello, this is Debbie back again on March 16th, 2016, with the e-edition of the Herald and Review, starting section 2, as we usually do with the obituaries. Decatur Ward, Rebecca Ann. Rebecca Ann Ward, 71, a Decatur, passed away Wednesday, March 9th, 2016, at Symphony of Decatur. Funeral services will be 1 o'clock Saturday, March 19th at Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, with visitation 1 hour prior to service at the funeral home. Burial will be in Illini Cemetery, Warrensburg, Illinois. Oakley, Weaver, Helen. Helen Joanne Weaver, 74, of Oakley, passed away Saturday, March 12, 2016, at home surrounded by her family. Honoring Joanne's wishes, cremation services will be provided by Graceland Fairlawn Crematory. No services are planned at this time. Memorials will be directed to Cancer Care Specialists of Central Illinois, SC. Effingham, Meitzner, Gary A. Gary A. Meitzner passed away Saturday, March 12, 2016. Services, funeral service at Living Word United Methodist Church on Manchester Road, Wildwood, Friday. So that's Living Word United Methodist Church, 17315 Manchester Road, Wildwood, Friday, 11 a.m. Interment, Bethel Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to the American Cancer Society. Visitation will be at the Schrader Funeral Home on Manchester Road in Holloway, Baldwin, Thursday 4 to 8, and at the church Friday 10 to 10:45. Monticello, Elliot Thomas S. Thomas S. Elliot, 52, of Monticello, passed away at 8:15 a.m. Sunday, March 13, 2016. A visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 17th, at Mackie Wright Funeral Home, Monticello. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, March 18th, at the Mackie Wright Funeral Home, with Reverend Curtis Bultman officiating, and burial will be held in Monticello Township Cemetery at 11:30 a.m. In lieu of flowers, charitable donations to a worthy cancer charity or the USO to support our troops at uso.org would be greatly appreciated. Riverton, Cyber, Nancy May. Nancy May Blakeman Cyber, 79, of Riverton, passed away on Saturday, March 12th, at Memorial Medical Center. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 on Thursday, March 17th, at South Tower Community Church in Dawson. Memorial services will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, March 18th, at the church, with Pastor Charlie Carver officiating. Burial will follow at Camp Butler National Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the APL, Abate, or South Tower Community Church. Sullivan, Horath, Patricia J. Patricia J. Horath, 65, of Sullivan, passed away 11:40 p.m. Sunday, March 13, 2016, at Sullivan Healthcare, Sullivan. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 18th, at McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 Thursday, March 17th, at McMullen Young Funeral Home, Sullivan. Burial will be in French Cemetery, Sullivan. Memorials may be made to the American Diabetes Association or to the American Heart Association. Arthur Hughes, Leona Marie. Leona Marie Hughes, 88, of Arthur, died at 8:15 Friday, March 11th, at the Arthur Home. Memorial service will be held 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 19th, at the Arthur United Methodist Church, with Reverend Bruce Wayman officiating. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, March 18th, at Schrader Funeral Home on Vine Street in Arthur. Burial will be in the Zion Church Cemetery, rural Arthur. That is the end of the death notices in today's Herald and Review, March 16th. At the very end of the obituary page is a little short paragraph that says, "Woman fights to keep pet alligator in home." This is AP Lakeland, Florida. A Florida woman is fighting to keep her 6-foot-long pet alligator in her home. The 125-pound reptile named Rambo wears clothes, rides on the back of a motorcycle, and has a bedroom in Mary Thorne's home in Lakeland. Thorne has a license for the alligator, has had a license for the alligator for 11 years, but it recently grew to 6 feet. Wildlife officials say that size alligator must have 2.5 acres of land. Thorne tells the Orlando Sentinel that even if she had land available, Rambo couldn't be left outdoors because of sensitivity to sunlight. Thorne takes Rambo to schools and charity events to teach people about reptiles. She has trained him not to bite. For Florida Wildlife Commission spokesman Gary Moore said Thorne's case is under investigation. Okay, that is the end of that article. Quick article on the beginning of the sports page. Palmer feeling his age is turning years. This is out of Orlando, Florida. A golf cart driving onto the practice range and parking behind players to watch them swing isn't typically met with this kind of enthusiasm, unless the guy behind the wheel in his pink shirt is Arnold Palmer. This was late Monday afternoon at Bay Hill, and these are Palmer's peoples, tour players at work on the range. They come over to say hello, some to introduce themselves. The Arnold Palmer Invitational enters its 638th year with one noticeable difference. The king won't be around as much as he usually is this week. Palmer is 86 and not moving around as well as he once did. He decided not to hold a press conference for the first time this year, instead taking questions that reporters submitted last week. That's where he revealed that he won't be hitting the opening tee shot at the Masters this year, though he still plans to keep the same schedule at Augusta National, the champion dinner on Tuesday, the first tee, without clubs Thursday morning, and then back to Orlando. Starting the money section is Stu Ellis's Farmers Deserve Thank You. This week is National Agriculture Week and a time to tip our cap to farmers. Farmers down the road. Farmers a few counties or states over. Farmers in nations with political unrest which can't be found on the map. Farmers in black and white pictures who look like Dad or Granddad would have looked. And farmers who are newly minted by community colleges or top-rated land-grant agricultural colleges. They're all important because they produce the food that sustains us day to day. When Abraham Lincoln worked on his family farm in western Macon County 185 years ago, there wasn't any neighborhood Kroger, and Casey's convenience store certainly didn't exist to provide pizza. The cow was milk, eggs were gathered, some wheat and corn were harvested, and an uncountable number of wild animals provided fresh meat. Yes, there are a few folks like that today in remote areas of the United States who want to avoid society, but most everyone else would rather take advantage of today's remarkable agricultural industry that provides food, fuel, and fiber. Americans spend less than 10% of their disposable income on food, the least of any country. In return, they enjoy a food supply that's abundant, affordable, and among the world's safest. That is not the case in the rest of the world, where food is more expensive and food safety exists only in tourist areas. The global population will be demanding more food as it grows to 9 billion in the next 35 years, so abundant food will be required, and the world is looking toward the U.S. to meet that challenge. Well, there are 2 million U.S. farms. The way the U.S. Department of Agriculture defines a farm, the heart of the watermelon is populated by 210,000 full-time commercial farmers who produce 80% of the food moving through farm-to-market channels. You know them. You go to church with them, shake their hand, and give them a pat on the back for a job well done. That typical farmer feeds 155 people. Assemble that many in your backyard sometime for a picnic and you realize why farms are growing in size, why farm equipment takes up more than half the roadway, and wintertime television commercials frequently promote herbicides and other crop protection chemicals. It's big business, and it has to be, because the farmer only pockets about a dime for every dollar you spend on food. With such narrow margins, profitability only comes with volume. In the last 35 years, farm productivity has increased to such a degree that it has brought Star Wars technology to every farm field and every tractor. In that period of time, agricultural productivity has increased 96%. That's 35 years, 96%. Yields have climbed 55%, and number of planted acres has increased 24%. But to do that, farmers have had to take care of the precious soil that produces your food. 3 out of 4 have indicated they have taken action to improve the quality of their soil. In the past 30 years, soil erosion has fallen 66%. Use of irrigation water has declined 42%. Energy use on farms has dropped 48%, and greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture has been cut 49%. But to reduce inputs while increasing outputs, agriculture has made a concerted shift to employ biotechnology. In 2014, 18 million farmers in 28 countries raised biotech crops, which helped 16.5 million of them escape poverty by increasing yields. Those farmers also saved 325 million acres from being newly cultivated because less land was needed to produce food. And while doing that, their yields increased by 22%. When you take a bite of food this week, thank a farmer. End of the article. Next article in the money section, cost for name brand prescription drugs double. This is by Kim Jansen, Tribune News Service writer. Average branded prescription drug prices have nearly doubled over the last 5 years, according to the nation's largest pharmacy benefits organization. In a report that could fuel the growing political outcry against high drug prices, pharmacy benefits manager Express Scripts said, opportunistic manufacturers and scheming pharmacies helped drive up prices by 98.2% since 2011. High prescription drug costs have become an issue in the presidential primary campaign, with candidates in both the Democratic and Republican races proposing measures to control prices. And pharma bro Martin Shkreli became the face of the issue in September when he jacked up the prices of a life-saving AIDS and cancer drug from $13.50 to $750 per pill. Express Scripts, which negotiates contracts for drug coverage on behalf of insurers and employers, said in the report that price increases are occurring with greater magnitude and frequency than in recent years, and that in 2015, nearly one-third of branded drugs experienced annual price increases of 20%. It blamed consolidation in the prescription drug market and price gouging for diluting the value of generic medications and lower-cost therapies. Branded drug prices increased by 16.2% in 2015, Express Scripts said. But if there's a glimmer of hope, it was that the growth in overall spending on drugs slowed. By using more generics, which comprise 84% of all prescriptions and which fell in price by 19.9% in 2015, the total spend per patient on prescription drugs increased by a more modest 5.2%, a smaller rise than the 13.1% increase in 2014. Both increased drug prices and increased demand for drugs drove the higher costs, Express Scripts said. The price increases are further evidence of an issue that has increasingly grabbed headlines during this election cycle. Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Republican hopeful Donald Trump called for Medicare to use its bargaining power to negotiate lower prices and for Americans to be allowed to import cheaper drugs from overseas. Medicare spending per patient on drugs increased by 10.9% in 2015, driven by a 27.9% increase in spending on specialty drugs, according to Express Scripts. Among the 10 classes of treatment that make the most revenue for drug makers, prices for skin condition medication up by 26.4% and heartburn ulcers up by 36.3% rose the most. End of that article. More locally, EIU faculty union rejects cuts. This is by Gerard Jarman from the Lee News Service. Charleston, Eastern Illinois University faculty and academic support employees are considering a deferral in salaries after a recent rejection of the Eastern administration's previous proposal that included salary reductions. According to the EIU, UPI faculty union news release, with a 70% voting participation rate, the faculty and academic support personnel voted not to accept Eastern President David Glassman's proposed 5.6% reduction in the base salary of faculty and academic support. UPI leadership offered a different proposal that would defer salaries of faculty and academic support employees to make up for the money needed for the payroll for the rest of the fiscal year. The news release states, quote, "The need for sufficient cash flow to continue operation was readily recognized by nearly all faculty and academic support personnel," unquote, but that the Eastern administration proposal had shortcomings. The salary reduction proposal was unfair to more financially vulnerable UPI members, according to EIU-UPI. Quote, "Our members deserve a proposal they can trust, something that helps EIU with the cash flow problem that Governor Bruce Rauner has forced upon us while allowing us to do our job to educate our students and to protect our campus and community," said Jonathan Blitz, EIU-UPI president. Billy Hung, H-U-N-G, EIU, UPI media coordinator, said the UPI proposal has key differences besides deferring instead of reducing salaries. Instead of a flat rate for all faculty and academic support employees, those members with a base salary of $50,000 or less will defer a total sum equal to 2.5% of their annual base contract salary. Those with salary of $50,001 to $75,000, 5%. Those with salary of $75,001 to $100,000, 6.5%. And those with salaries of $100,001 or more, 7.5%. This would open up more than $2 million to be used, more than the Glassman's requested amount. Hung said this also protects those in the lower brackets from as much financial difficulty as there would be with a flat rate. The UPI proposal also differs in the repayment process. The proposal would use money assigned to MAP grants as well as fiscal year 2016 and 2017 appropriations, unlike the other proposal that would only take this FY 2016 funding. Also, from when appropriations come in, for every dollar Eastern gets, UPI gets a dollar to repay the deferrals. From all appropriations, equal amounts will be assigned to the administration and to UPI until all deferrals have been repaid or until the entire appropriation has been exhausted, the proposal also reads. For example, in the case of a $4 million appropriation, $2 million would be allocated to refund UPI deferred salaries, and $2 million would be allocated to EIU. If Eastern receives no state funding in FY 2016 and FY 2017, the deferral will be converted to a reduction and the university would not have to pay back the owed amount. The faculty and academic support personnel will vote on this pay deferral plan starting on March 21st and concluding on March 22nd. EIU-UPI represents 515 members of tenure-track faculty, annually contracted faculty, and academic support personnel. Next article on technology. Robotics expert, self-driving car not ready for deployment. This is AP out of Washington. Self-driving cars are, quote, absolutely not, end quote, ready for widespread deployment despite a rush to put them on the road, a robotics expert warned Tuesday. The cars aren't yet able to handle bad weather, including standing water, drizzling rain, sudden downpours, and snow. Missy Cummins, director of Duke University's robotics program, told the Senate Commerce Committee, and they certainly aren't equipped to follow the directions of a police officer, she said. While enthusiastic about research into self-driving cars, quote, I am excitingly less optimistic about what I perceive to be a rush to field systems that are absolutely not ready for widespread deployment, and certainly not ready for humans to be completely taken out of the driver's seat, she said. It's relatively easy for hackers to take control of the GPS navigation system of self-driving cars, Cummings said. It is feasible that people could commandeer self-driving vehicles to do their bidding, which could be malicious or simply for the thrill of it, she said, adding that privacy of personal data is another concern. But General Motors and Google officials who testified before the committee voiced worries that a patchwork of state and local laws will hinder deployment of the vehicles. They emphasized that the vast majority of auto fatalities are caused by human error, and self-driving cars hold the potential for eliminating many of those errors. They also pointed to the vehicle's potential to improve the lives of the disabled. In the past 2 years, 23 states have introduced 53 pieces of legislation that affect self-driving cars, said Chris Urmson, director of Google's self-driving car program. He urged lawmakers to move swiftly to grant the Secretary of Transportation new authority to get innovative safety technologies like self-driving cars into the marketplace. Critics have complained that the cumbersome federal rulemaking process means it sometimes takes the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration close to a decade to set standards and issue regulations for new technology, by which time the technologies have already been displaced by even newer ones. NHTSA said last week in a report there are significant legal hurdles to allowing fully autonomous cars without steering wheels. The agency is working on new policies aimed at getting the self-driving cars on the road sooner. Michael Abelson, GM's vice president for strategy, said he believes it will only be a few years before the cars come into use, so they may not be fully autonomous at first. None of the witnesses except Cummings was willing to say the government should set minimum standards for the vehicles to protect the privacy of the data they gather and to prevent hacking, despite being pressed by Senator Edward Markey, Democrat, Massachusetts, to support mandatory standards. These cars are going to be one big data-gathering machine, Cummings said. It's not clear who's going to be doing what with that data. She also said she believed NHTSA staff doesn't have technological capability to set standards with automakers on what they must do to prevent hacking and protect misuse of data. The first ride many people will take in a self-driving car is likely to be when they use their cell phone to hail a car through ride-sharing service like Lyft or Uber, witnesses said. Lyft and GM have formed a partnership to help bring the cars into everyday use. End of article. Moving to the life section, section D of the Herald and Review for March 16th, we have a Justin Kahn staff writer article on health, medicine, and fitness. Experts agree that stretching before and after activity has its benefits. Click a link or ask an athletic trainer about stretching, and the results will be different every time. There's evidence that stretching does little to nothing for soreness, preventing energy or performance. In fact, there are stretches that are potentially damaging and others that may limit performance. It doesn't matter if you look it up online or in peer-reviewed journal articles written by physicians. The evidence is conflicting, Decatur Memorial Hospital Athletic Training Outreach Coordinator Matt Munjoy said. But most experts agree there's a place for certain types of stretches both before and after physical activity. If done correctly, it's not going to hurt you, St. Mary's Hospital athletic trainer Crystal Ziegler said. I think it comes down to experience. You develop your own routine through trial and error. If you run 3 miles and didn't stretch and you feel fine, great. But if your calves are tight the next day, try stretching them after. It can definitely help with that. I would never discourage someone from stretching. Here's the closest thing to consensus. Dynamic stretching before activity and static stretching after can help with flexibility and decrease soreness. Unlike the more traditional static stretching, think toe stretches or stretch and hold, dynamic stretches involve stretching while moving, like high knees, high kicks, and what Ziegler refers to as Frankenstein. If you go to a football game and watch warm-ups, that's what you'll see, stretching multiple muscles while simultaneously moving and warming them up. They're not necessarily stretching them to their end range, they're getting them warmed up, and it seems to be best at getting the body loose and ready to participate in activity. What we find is that static stretching is good after the body's been warmed up, particularly after activity or after practice. We use a lot of it in rehab with people who aren't able to do movement stretching but are trying to get their full range of motion back. The effects of static stretching are the most hotly debated. In some circles, the theory is that stretching the muscles as far as they can be stretched and holding them there gets them used to being in that range, helping with flexibility and preventing muscle pulls. But there have also been studies that show athletic performance decreases after static stretching. I know that theory's out there, and I don't do a lot of static stretches before performance with the athletes I work with, Munjoy said. I think when static stretches are done before the body's warmed up, it may tighten a little. I think no matter what you're doing, You want to get your heart rate and body temperature up first. I never like to see muscles used in a cold state, but I've seen static stretches immediately after activity help people whose muscles tighten up on them. I've seen people alleviate back pain after workouts by stretching their hamstrings and quads and giving themselves more flexibility and functional range of motion they need. The types of stretches needed can depend on the type of activity. Central A&M High School track and field coach Todd Rourke, whose teams have won 2 state titles and had several individual champions, has different stretching exercises for each group of athletes depending on the event they participate in. Stretching for an athlete throwing the discus is different than a hurdler. Stretching is part of our warm-ups, and we try to make warm-up routines that benefit each competitor best, Rourke said. Rourke's stretching warm-ups fall in line with the general consensus. Don't stretch cold muscles and do static stretches after activity. Though static and dynamic stretching are the most used, there are other types of stretching. Bunjoy said he advised staying away from one type of stretching, in particular ballistic. It's controversial. It's movement while stretching that includes bouncing and pushing the muscles to and past their end range. I remember seeing some professionals do it when I was younger, but I don't recommend it. It's a method that's out there, but I don't like what it does to joints. End article. Continuing with this Health Med Fit and Justin Kahn, the headline says, not all fats are the same. When considering fat in food, it used to be easy. Fat is bad. But through the years, science had found that not all fats are the same. On food labels, 4 different types of fat are listed. University of Illinois Extension nutrition educator Caitlin Huth said it's important to know the difference between them. I wouldn't worry about the chemistry. That's complicated, Huth said, but it's important to know the good and bad. Food labels are really useful, except if you don't understand them. The 4 types of fat are saturated, The 4 types of food are saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, and trans. The thing to remember, there is no food has just one kind of fat. They all have different ratios, but there's almost always a mix. The one type of fat that should always be avoided is trans fat. I'll say that again. The one type of fat that should always be avoided is trans fat, which leads to coronary artery disease and has been linked to other diseases such as Alzheimer's, cancer, and diabetes. Trans fats are commonly in margarine, Crisco, and anything containing partially hydrogenated oils. Recently, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration ruled that all foods produced in the U.S. must be free of trans fats by 2018 unless approved by the FDA. You used to see it a lot more in the food industry, but the food industry has done a good job of getting rid of it in most foods, Huth said. Saturated fat is solid and usually found in animal and dairy. The effects on the body are controversial, but most dietitians advise moderation. The 2 types of unsaturated fats, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated, are considered heart healthy when eaten in moderation. Omega-3 fatty acids, which are in many types of seafood, are a polyunsaturated fat that have been shown to lower the risk of heart attacks. Foods containing unsaturated fats include avocado, nuts, seeds, and vegetable oils, such as canola and olive oils. While unsaturated fats are considered healthy, the FDA still recommends they shouldn't exceed 30% of daily caloric intake. That is the end of that article, the end of the page in the life section. And also, we have come to the end of part 2 of the e-edition of the Herald and Review on March 16th, 2016, brought to you by Debbie. I will talk to you again soon.